actually does anything to benefit the material effects of climate change.
So perhaps an interpretation could be that the city's reversal hinges on this idea of Zenith doing renewable fuels rather than fossil fuels, and there's this sort of phase-out aspect of it as well. But you also write that that contains a loophole for Zenith in that agreement. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, one of the records that we found was a email from now Carmen Rubio's chief of staff, Gillian Schoen, to kind of talk about this and saying that the ban on fossil fuels will happen over time as supply grows, the supply of renewable diesel that would be blended with traditional fossil fuels. And she said, but we do need to move away from fossil fuel diesel, and renewable diesel is that answer. There is a provision in the draft policy to pay close attention to supply and adjust as required. If there's not enough supply of renewables, then essentially they need to continue to provide what they do now, which is fossil fuels. They are a fossil fuel transportation and storage company.
There's also another agreement that you write was discreetly signed to allow Zenith to install two additional pipes under Northwest Front Avenue. What can you tell me about that decision?
After they purchased the asphalt terminal in 2017, they applied for a new franchise agreement in 2019. They wanted to build three new pipes beneath Northwest Front Avenue. They were denied that request because it ran contrary to the city's determination that fossil fuels pose a risk to safety, health, and livability. Now, it's seen as a huge victory for environmental advocates. But I started asking around, and through the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, someone sent me a signed letter of agreement between the BPS director, that's the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Zenith's COO. And that was dated on July 31st, that is essentially in a letter of agreement. So there's been no change to the official franchise agreement. This is a letter that will allow them to install two additional pipes. There are some provisions saying that it must be renewable. There are some like enforcement mechanisms that are put in place. With that said, coupled with the idea of paying attention to supply, it's hard to tell if those will actually effectively be used only for renewable fuels in 5 years, as Zenith has promised.
With all of this in mind, where do the Zenith permits and construction plans stand now?
So now that Zenith has their LUX permit, they, in November 2022, they applied for a lower tier DEQ permit, which essentially brings down the amount of pollutants and emissions that they are allowed to emit. DEQ is currently drafting that permit, according to DEQ spokesperson Harry Estevez. That is going to include a 35-day public comment period. So they're on their way to getting their air quality permit, which was the point of needing to get this new revised LUX. And so they're essentially they're on pace to do business moving forward.
Were there things in this reporting process that you were surprised by?
I was surprised to see that there are after so many conversations and public comments that were strikingly similar, I was a bit surprised to see how much quiet communication there was between city officials and staff and a public relations firm. It's an advertising agency. And I was kind of surprised to see that the city officials who were in a position to win in court based on how the city had been moving, I was surprised to see that they kind of bought into this advertising agency's plan so quickly and so consistently over a few months.
What do you hope that listeners and readers take away from this story?
Sometimes these things can be extremely boring. Something like a land use compatibility statement, you know, there might be 14 people who are in the city of Portland who are really interested in something like that. But these really minute decisions actually have significant impacts.
This is a KBOO Evening News special, the best of 2023. It's also KBOO's end of year campaign. So if our volunteer reporting has meant something to you this year, consider supporting KBOO. 80% of our funds come from members, and you could be one of them. KBOO.fm/give is the online link to donate, but you can also text KBOO to 44321. Let's get back into our look back at some of the best Street Roots interviews this year. This story was from October when I spoke with Indigenous Affairs reporter Melanie Henshaw about her article titled Tribal Forests Underfunded. Tribally managed forests lack funding to address myriad issues, new report finds. Welcome to the show, Melanie.
Hi, Althea. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So your new piece breaks down the Indian Forest Management Assessment Team 4, released by the Intertribal Timber Council, and it talks about the status and needs of tribally managed forests. To start out here, who is on this council and what are they analyzing?
It's a nationwide group comprised of various tribal nations, Alaska Native corporations, and other individuals committed to tribal forestry. And for the report, they convene forestry experts to examine tribal forests and forestry while visiting dozens of tribal nations, meeting with natural resource departments, tribal governments, and tribal citizens.
What is the acreage like of Oregon forests that are tribally managed?
So 7 of the 9 federally recognized tribal nations in Oregon manage approximately 516,000 acres of forest land. It fluctuates as land is being brought into trust all the time. And there's also some acreage that may be managed outside of trust or in other ways operated by the tribe. So that's not accounted for in the 516,000 acre number.
So in looking at this report, what were some of the highest priorities for tribes when it comes to managing forests?
Tribes have a slightly different vision when it comes to forest management than the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. Generally, the vision for tribal forestry is more aggressively focused on sustainability and forest protection, and tribal members rate highly the ability to collect non-timber forest products and access their forest for cultural and spiritual means much higher than revenue generation through timber harvest.
What are some examples of non-timber forest products?
That can be everything from wild mushrooms to berries, fish, grasses, any non-timber product that can be taken out of the forest. And their uses are many. They're used as food sources, as medicines, used in ceremonies for crafting.
Now, you also cover that this report outlines some of the challenges that there are when it comes to harvesting these non-forest timber products, and wildfires can play into that. Can you tell me about that aspect?
Some of the issues that these NTFPs, as they're sometimes called, are facing are, you know, habitat destruction, declining populations. Now, habitat destruction could obviously come through the form of wildfires. And some of the other issues that are touched on in this report is one of the ways that wildfires are managed are through what's called prescribed burns or controlled burns, which are healthy for the forest, but are often set using a tool called a drip torch. But essentially that results in chemicals being dripped onto the ground. And in the Pacific Northwest, a really common weaving material is bear grass, and this report found that sometimes the contaminants from drip torches can end up on bear grass, which is then harvested by weavers, and often the weavers are putting this material in their mouths, so that can lead to potentially negative health effects for folks who are using that product. That doesn't say that prescribed burns are negative or bad. It's just a potential consequence of one of the tools that's used.
Yeah, you also mentioned this report that King 5 Washington did about fire retardant and how that impacts some of these products. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So King 5 Washington recently released a report that found that the U.S. Forest Service dropped retardant on or near water 45 times in the Pacific Northwest between 2012 and 2019, including waterways that are in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. And that is negative because the retardant that is dropped in the waterways is harmful to fish and other wildlife. And the report found that the errant retardant drops killed thousands of fish, including endangered steelhead and salmon species.
Well, to go back to what you identified in the title of this article, underfunding is one of the biggest difficulties that tribes face when it comes to forest management. Can you break that down? What role does funding or lack thereof play in how this goes?
Right, absolutely. So tribal forests are funded at about one-third of the amount per acre as U.S. Forest Service and BLM managed land. So that underfunding has contributed to many issues that they highlight in the report, such as the infrastructure that tribes have in their forest is in bad condition. And when I'm referring to infrastructure, I mean forest roads and the like. Then tribal forestry departments are understaffed, and the staff that they do have are working with low pay. And the low pay essentially means that these jobs that they have in tribal forestry departments can't compete with equivalent jobs in BLM or the U.S. Forest Service. They have trouble attracting folks to work these jobs in tribal forestry departments. And that issue is also compounded by the fact that there's often poor housing. Now, these underfunded and short-staffed tribal forestry departments are having to contend with immediate threats to tribal forests, like pests, disease, and wildfire.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Can you break down some of the threats that those pose?
Wildfire obviously is a threat that we're facing a lot here on the West Coast and, of course, in Oregon. And these wildfires are burning more and more land, and it's exacerbated through climate change. Due to heavy fire suppression tactics over the past century, these fires are burning extremely hot and even destroying species that are adapted to some level of fire. And other issues that tribal forests are facing are pests like the emerald ash borer, which decimates ash trees, and sudden oak death, which affects oak species, and that's a disease. And now those are two types of wood that are extremely valuable to tribes. So for tribal forestry departments, they need funding, but they also need capacity. They need more staff and more trained foresters in order to address these threats like wildfire, pests, and disease.
How do controlled burns play in? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but are there times that a controlled or prescribed burn isn't a successful tactic based on the state of forests today?
Yeah, so I actually, in my conversation with one of the co-chairs of the Intertribal Timber Council, he said that essentially once trees and foliage in the understory reaches a certain point of maturity, controlled burns are no longer going to be an effective tactic for managing that forest. And you need to go in with what's called mechanical thinning, which is essentially chainsaws, and you're cutting things down. Or they can also put like a toxin into the tree that will kill it, like inject the tree with a toxin. And those are methods that can be used after the certain point has been reached in which prescribed burns would no longer be an effective way to manage that particular forest land.
Yeah, I thought that point was especially interesting. I appreciate you explaining it. What did the report conclude about tribal timber production?
So tribal timber production in the surveys that the ITC conducted was found to be important, but less important to tribal members than non-timber forest products and forest protection. But still important because timber production is used to generate revenue that's often used to fund programs to support tribal members directly, like housing, education, and healthcare. So tribes often are not able to harvest the what's called the maximum allowable cut, which is essentially a metric that's set each year that determines the maximum amount of timber that an entity can harvest from a particular area. Tribes are typically not meeting that, and that's for a variety of reasons, including, as I mentioned, a focus and priority on forest protection and sustainability over revenue generation. But nonetheless, the report quantified how much money was being lost when tribes are not reaching the maximum allowable cut, and found that nationwide it's about $40 million per year lost. So it, like I said, it's a complex issue where tribes do want to harvest timber for revenue, but it's often not the number one priority. And now I'm speaking very generally here. There's more than 300 tribes in Turtle Island that manage forest land. This report just characterizes generally tribes having a stronger focus on forest protection and sustainability while maintaining some level of importance for revenue generation as well.
So where does the report go from here?
Right. So this is a congressionally mandated report that is produced every 10 years. This is the fourth such report, and from here, it will be presented to Congress before a Senate committee and also before a House committee, where the researchers will present their findings, make their recommendations, and, of course, be questioned by senators and congresspeople on their findings and recommendations as well. And it's looking like potentially this year they might actually hold this hearing outside, which would be kind of interesting.
That does sound interesting. What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
Well, I think it's important to note that this is, again, more than 500,000 acres of forest land in sharing space with Oregonians. And so this is important because forestry management practices is, I'll say, a hot topic here in the Pacific Northwest. And I think it's important to highlight that the tribes are managing a significant amount of land and they're doing things a little bit differently. And when I spoke with one of the co-chairs who wrote this report, he said that generally tribally managed forests are in somewhat better condition than forests managed by BLM or the U.S. Forest Service.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to a very special edition of the KBOO Evening News. It's the best of 2023. Today, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews with the team at Street Roots. In the last story of our show tonight, I spoke with Jeremiah Hayden on August 9th about a record number of in-custody deaths at Multnomah County jails. Now that number has reached 7. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. This is obviously a heavy topic, these in-custody deaths at Multnomah County jails. Let's start with the latest death and work backwards. What do we know about the most recent deceased?
Not a lot. These are still under medical examiner investigations. So Multnomah County announced last week that a 36-year-old had died in the Multnomah County Detention Center downtown on August 1st. Not a lot of details beyond that.
And then there have been 5 other deaths just since the beginning of May, which is a pretty serious number. What do we know about those deaths?
We are still waiting on medical examiner reports for 4 of those deaths. Street Roots chooses not to talk about names until we've actually reached out to families if people want to speak. But 4 are still under investigation, and 2 of them we have records about those deaths. One was a 58-year-old, one person was 26 years old, and not a lot of information beyond that. But
so put these in context for me. Is this something that is normal, that is regular, that is something to be expected?
No. This is a lot for 3 months. This is actually a lot for a year, and it's actually a lot for even 2 or 3 years combined. So there were 3 total deaths in 2021 and 2022 in Multnomah County. I believe there were 0 deaths in 2020 as well, but we don't have specific records on that. So 6 in 3 months is quite a few.
What kind of action has the county taken in reaction to this spike in deaths?
Multnomah County Sheriff's Office released a statement the same day that our article came out in Street Roots. And, you know, they said that there's no reason to believe the deaths are connected. Medical examiner is, you know, still under investigations, and they take their responsibility seriously. So a few hours just right before our article came out last week, Multnomah County Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell sent out a press release saying that they're implementing some short-term strategies like outside assessment of facilities, changing some physical characteristics inside the jails, expanding naloxone in the event of an overdose, and a few just kind of, you know, healthcare-related things to try to address.
One thing I found especially interesting in your article was from Oregon Justice Resource Center attorney Juan Chavez, who's quoted in your article, talking about the legal distinction between a prison and a jail. What is the difference there, and why does it matter?
Chavez, you know, says essentially jails are to hold people who have not actually been convicted with for a crime. So these are places where, as he says, you're not meant to be punished, you're meant to be held. For punishment, when people are found guilty or enter a guilty plea, that's what prison is for. That is a critical distinction because, you know, anyone really in our society, accidents happen, things happen very unexpectedly, and, you know, essentially anyone in our society could end up with a little short stay in jail. So It actually does have a pretty great effect, a significant effect on, you know, anybody who ends up in a short stay in jail.
So these 6 folks who died, had they been convicted of a crime?
5 out of 6 people had not been convicted or otherwise entered a guilty plea.
How do Multnomah County jails stack up against other county jail systems? Are there metrics to understand how things are going relatively?
Well, as far as like the question of guilty or not guilty pleas with prisoners in Multnomah County jails, I'm talking about jails nationwide between the year 2000 and 2019. And the study found that, you know, it's not really uncommon for people. They found that 77% of people who died in jail within those 19 years had not been convicted of crime. And like 40% of people had been in custody for a week or less. That's something that we see here in the Multnomah County jails as well. You know, and 60% of people who died were incarcerated for less than 30 days. So it's not common that this would be the case, you know, on a national level or in jails anywhere nationally, but it is significant.
You write that Multnomah County jails have also been the subject of a few lawsuits in the past couple years. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah. So in 2020, some prisoners have brought lawsuits about 2020, including like allegations of them failing to protect prisoners from tear gas during protests because the Multnomah County Detention Center is inside the Justice Center where a lot of those protests were ongoing in that summer. And so some prisoners came together and ended up suing for the failure to protect them from that tear gas. Some have filed a lawsuit about COVID-19 and failing to protect them. That suit was filed in 2021. And then in 2022, somebody filed a lawsuit about the county health failing to treat a broken nose of a prisoner as well.
You also, in the article, talk about the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare, which offers accreditation to jail systems like this. What did they say about Multnomah County?
So the Multnomah County Detention Center was placed on probation in July of 2021 after the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare, NCCHC. They had done an on-site visit that revealed some substandard health conditions. Willamette Week initially reported on that in December of 2021. That jail in particular was only in full compliance with 2/3 of the essential standards, which is basically accreditation is intended to improve the healthcare quality in carceral facilities, and just make sure that people are meeting basic constitutional standards. They were resurveyed again in 2021. They regained their accreditation status. And apparently, at least those issues that they were looking at that time appear to have been addressed.
You also touch on the ballot measure that Multnomah County voters passed in 2022, requiring that county commissioners tour jail facilities twice per year. Why is that important? How does that tie into what we're talking about now?
Multnomah County voters passed this measure, 26-233 in 2022, that requires an additional inspection of Multnomah County commissioners in MCSO-administered jails. So the first one was actually passed in 2006, which is basically to provide some public accountability and ensure that officials are running jails according to their best practices. There's a added layers of security in this second one that requires a member of the public to join city commissioners along for that tour. So they're limited, once to twice a year. I talked to Multnomah County Commissioner Sutila Jayapal, who basically said if somebody thinks we're in the jails for 1 or 2 days and that's going to give us a whole understanding of jail conditions, that's really not the case. Much more is needed to be done.
I mean, to that point, what is the role that county commissioners play in oversight of these jails and their conditions?
All of that funding and, a lot of these choices and decisions about jails do come down to, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office is within the Multnomah County system, and they vote and make rules, that actually apply to, how people experience time in the carceral system. So,
in reporting on this story, were there aspects that you found surprising?
I was surprised to find that, from talking with Juan Chavez at the Oregon Justice Resource Center, I was kind of surprised to find that, a person taking their own life in jail is even possible. It seems like when a person enters a jail and they're under the comprehensive care of the state, it seems like that would be a really difficult thing to do, particularly if somebody comes in who is at risk. And so I was kind of surprised to find, of the two cause and manner of death that we have records of this year, two of these are suicides. And I think that people having access to that in the first place is, to tools that would make that possible is a little bit surprising.
What are the takeaways that you hope people get from this story?
I hope that people understand that, six deaths in a world of, it's easy for people to get fatigued about this stuff, but six deaths in a jail, this is a state system, and that's a significant number, and this is a system that can and should improve. And as Juan Chavez said, if they don't have the staff to be able to do this, if they're not able to actually take care of people, then, he would prefer that they just release people. Now, that doesn't mean that, I can see the critique being, you just want to release murderers or something like that. That doesn't necessarily mean that. There are a lot of people who are in jail because of the cash bail system that is, people with small fines, $20, $50, $100 bail that they can't pay. And, some of those people, if people are overwhelmed, there might be something that could be done about that.
You've been listening to a special edition of the KBOO Evening News, the best of 2023. In this hour, we've been taking a look back at some of our favorite Street Roots interviews from the past year. My thanks to the team at Street Roots for continuing to collaborate with us and for all the great reporting that they do. I want to thank everyone who volunteered with the KBOO News team in 2023. You guys make it all possible. And last but not least, a thank you to our listeners and members who support this unique radio station and our news show. We're so proud to bring you local, volunteer-produced news every weekday. If you would like to support KBOO and the evening news, you can. Donate today at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. One last thank you before I go. Thank you for listening. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO Community Radio is listener supported. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during our annual end of year campaign, your support can go even farther. Contribute today at kboo.fm/give and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now.
KBOO. To you, the 9 to 5-er, just